Welcome to Headlines. This is Ari Wasserman sitting in for David Lichtenstein. Today's show is unfortunately a very relevant topic. We're going to talk about debt. Currently, debt, consumer debt, is at an all-time historical high. Certainly, the coronavirus did not help. We are seeing high levels of credit card debt, education debt, bank debt, government debt, borrowing from Gemachs. Debt is all over the place. Debt is rampant in society right now. And fundamentally, we're going to talk about, are there halachic ways to eliminate somebody's debt? If somebody took on debt but cannot pay, is unable to pay for whatever reason, somebody loses a job, the income goes down, the expenses go up, things change. When somebody took out the loan, he was able to pay it, but over time he is unable to pay it. Are there excuses? Are there ways halachically to cure that debt, to eliminate that debt? And in that vein, doesn't matter what type of debt it is. If it comes from a Jew, if it comes from a non-Jew, if it comes from a company, a corporation, if it comes from an individual, if it comes from a gemach, if it comes from a government, is there a nafka mina? Doesn't matter. In our discussion of, are there halachic ways to eliminate debt? We're also going to talk about other aspects of debt. For example, if somebody is taking out a loan, does he have to disclose the other debts that he already has? We will be talking about if somebody defaults on a loan, cannot pay it back, are there limitations that can be imposed on his spending of money? Because it should first and foremost go to pay off the debt. Can the creditor, for example, force a sale of the debtor's assets, including his home, or not? So that is going to be our conversation. Just to mention, when we have in our Birkas HaMazon and benching in the Brach of Rachemna, there is really a push, a bracha to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a request to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we should not need handouts from people, we shouldn't need tzedakah, and also we shouldn't need to take even a halva, even to take a debt. We say, V'nata tzricheinu Hashem Elokeinu, lo lidei matnas basar v'dam, not only taking out a gift, receiving a gift from somebody, but also v'lo lidei halvasam, we shouldn't even need a halva. So indeed, that should be our bracha, our request for a Kaddish Baruch Hu, that people should have parnasa and that we should not have needs to receive funds from other people. Rather, as we continue in the benching, Kim Liatcha Hameleya Hapsucha Hakadosha Vaharchava Kaddish Baruch Hu, please, that our whole source of funds, income, parnasa, should be directly from you and not via intermediary shlichim giving us handouts and giving us loans. So, in fact, this week's parsha, one of the two parshas, Parshas Bahar, does talk about loans, giving loans from one to another. It says the prohibition of charging usury. It's a mitzvah. It's not in this week's parsha, but there is a mitzvah to give a loan when there is a Jew in need. But when that loan is given, it has to be given interest-free, not interest-full. Usury, that is prohibited in Isra Doraisa, to Isra Doraisa. It says in the Pasuk, Al Tikach Mitor Neshech Vesarbis, list Neshech, Sarbis, different names for charging of interest, that there are two Isurim for charging interest. And the next Pasuk, we're now in Perek Chafei, Pasuk Lamed Zayin, it says, as kaspecha lo sita lo b'neshach, when you give somebody money, don't charge him interest. And also, v'marbis lo sita nachlecha, and also, don't increase your assets. For example, if you lend somebody food, if you give them, you lend them two apples, don't charge them. Over time, you're going to get a third one back to get repaid by three. That is a form of interest as well. So there's an interesting drush on this pasuk brought by Rav Shimon Sofer, and he says as follows. There's some people that they violate this prohibition and they give loans to other Jews and they charge interest. Isra Doraisa, they charge interest, and they rationalize it by saying that we have high parnasa needs, we have such high expenses, and I have no other choice but to earn a living through lending and charging interest to other people. And he says your solution is the second part of the pasuk. Uvemarbis lasita nachlecha, the whole reason that you have to bring in all this extra income is because you have high luxurious expenses. You're spending a lot on food and other luxuries that you don't really need. Uvemarbis, you have a lot. You have a lot of items that you don't need. Uvemarbis lasita nachlecha, you shouldn't be spending a lot on food. So he's saying the whole reason that you are needing to charge interest as kaspecha lasita Sitan Lalo B'neshach, the whole reason you're Kasbacha is B'neshach is because your Marbis is food. You're having a lot of food and other luxury items. If you cut out the luxuries, you won't have to be lending. And we would say the same thing. Sometimes it could very well be that people go into debt because they are spending on luxuries. And if they would cut out the luxuries, it would not be necessary to take on that debt. So we will talk about in the show as well what's considered good debt, what's bad debt, what's a good reason to take on debt, and what are bad reasons to take on debts. Joining on the show, we have an illustrious list of guests who will be interviewed on the show. We are going to start out with the Rosh Yeshiva of Eish HaTorah, who among his various expertises is the halachas of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. So we're going to speak with Rabbi Yitzchak Berkowitz. We are then going to go on and talk about many halachic aspects of debt, elimination of debt, with Rabbi Yosef Greenwald, who is a dayan, who is a posek, who is a rav of a shul, the Kalk Dexter Park. And then we are going to speak with Naftali Horowitz. He is a managing director at J.P. Morgan. He has also just put out a sefer that's relevant for us. And we're going to talk about some of the practical aspects and hashkafe aspects of finances and debt. And then we're going to speak with the chairman of Mesila. Mesila is a known organization, especially in Eretz Yisrael, and it is expanding worldwide. We're going to speak with the person who is the chairman, Shmuli Margulis, who's going to talk about what Mesila does and various eitzas that they have to assist people who are in debt and hopefully upfront avoid getting into the situation. And then we are going to end off the show with Rabbi Beryl Wein talking about debt and how it is to live with debt, not he himself, but he has strong advice against living in debt, and especially for the Clay Kodesh to avoid getting into debt. Before we go and meet with our guests, we are just going to quickly go through the riddle of the week. The riddle of the week is based on our pasuk that we brought. It's actually the pasuk before that we brought, Al tikach mitoneshech v'tarbis. So don't take from somebody when you're giving a loan. Don't take the various forms of interest. V'yareisa b'lokecha, you should fear HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows when somebody is charging interest or not. And then the pasuk finishes off by saying, V'chei achicha imach, that your brother, your brethren should live with you. Chazal teach us, based on these last words, v'chei achicha imach, that somebody who violates the prohibition and lends interest, somebody who indeed does give a Jew a loan and charges interest, will not be zoche, will not be merit to return in the Tchias HaMesim. And the question is, what is the connection between lending with interest, usury, violating the prohibition, and Tchias HaMesim? How are the two connected, that if somebody lends with interest, he or she will not be zoche to Tchias HaMesim?
I want to make an ad for our sponsor. I want to read two letters I got from listeners. Here's Ellie Cohn. He says, my son is a reader, and he spent all his time reading The Hunger Games, the Shadow Bone trilogy, and the Darkest Minds series. By his bar mitzvah, somebody went ahead and bought him the volumes of Headlines. Since then, by the Shabbos table, he's been speaking about killing a terrorist, guns and shuls, views on alcohol consumptions by Kiddush. You've changed his life. I would like to thank you very much. And signed, Ellie Cohn. Here's another letter I got from Izer Moskovsky. My family lives in the United Kingdom. I feel immense hakaras hatoiv to you for your books. They're the most borrowed book of our English Torah library. They have opened up the depth, clarity, and relevance of the Torah to our students. I use them constantly as the sefer to learn b'chavrusa with my students during our weekly learning sessions. They have been instrumental in giving so many their first taste of authentic, deep Torah and Svara Yeshara. We would love to have your latest book, Headlines 3, available too for our students. I am confident it will be the most loved and learned sefer on our shelves. Whatever. These are, if you want to really learn about interesting topics, keep your children discussing, debating by the table things other than politics, etc., go out and get Headlines 3. There are still some available in Svarim stores.
Rabbi Say, what are your thoughts? 732-806-8700, press number 2. That's for what the B'nai HaYeshiva have to say. or info@headlinesbook.com. We will post both messages, voicemails, as well as written, unless you request otherwise. But we're interested in what the Olam has to say.
Joining us now is Rabbi Yitzchak Berkowitz. Rabbi Berkowitz is the acclaimed Rosh Yeshiva of Eish HaTorah. He's the Rav of Sanhedrin Merchevet, the renowned Posek, and so much more. One of Rabbi Berkowitz's expertise is, he has many, is actually the Halachas of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. I have right in front of me seven volumes. I don't know if there are more, seven volumes of the Halachas of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. So a perfect fit for our topic. Rabbi Berkowitz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure. So Rabbi Berkowitz, this is a topic relevant for, unfortunately, everyone. So many people are laden with debt, and that can come from borrowing from a friend, going to a gemach, having a mortgage, credit card debt. There's so many forms of debt, and unfortunately, our society is built on living on debt. And the fundamental first question that we wanted to ask to start out here is, there's a concept in secular law of bankruptcy, that you can get out of your debt. And there are other ways as well. There are laws about a statute of limitations that you can get out of bank, out of debt as well. But halacha and the Torah, Chazal, they don't seem to have that concept of getting out of your debt. So what's the Torah's philosophy on debt in general?
So first, there's a very big difference between the issue of whether or not to allow yourself to get into debt and how to deal with debt once you're there. It is usur to make yourself needy. There's an Issur D'oraisa of Efes Kilo Yevecho Evyon, what sounds like the Torah telling us that you will never be a poor man among you. Chazal Darshan, that it just couldn't mean that. Because the Pasuk also says, Kilo Yechdal Evyon Mikerev Oretz. Hashem promises Klal Yisrael, there will always be needy around for you to help. It seems like the Jewish nation needed reassurance that there will never come a time that there'll be no one to give to. So Hashem said there will always be the needy. So what does the Pasuk mean when it says, Efes Kilo Yevecho Evyon, there will absolutely not be a poor man among you? And the Gemara in two places, the Gemara in Bava Metzi and Sanhedrin tell us, Efes Kilo Yevecho Evyon means don't make yourself needy. It is usur to make yourself needy. Now, Chazal are generally dealing with giving too much tzedakah. In other words, we take this as a halacha, you should not be giving more tzedakah than you can really afford, because ultimately you then will become needy yourself. And by the way, this is something that's not limited to funds. This will go for peace of mind. This will go for health. A social worker's burnout is a sign of someone who was not being careful with this. Giving too much of yourself and then turning yourself into becoming needy psychologically or financially is not permissible. Therefore, and so although it's talking about tzedakah, the Chafetz Chaim writes very clearly, it's obvious that the Torah doesn't want you to give too much tzedakah because you're going to make yourself poor. Certainly the Torah doesn't want you living unwisely in a way that you're going to make yourself poor. So that means that obviously you have to live, you can't live above your means. You've got to make sure that you're not wasting money. You've got to make sure that you're not spending money that perhaps you call it a need, but is inappropriate for a person of your means. You're not supposed to go into debt. To begin with, a second thing is borrowing money when you have no idea how you're going to repay it. I mean, that's just a form of geneva. That's theft. If you're borrowing money, the expectation is that you're going to pay back, and you don't really know how that's going to happen. So you're really taking money from someone and hoping that one way or another it's going to happen, but you don't have the plan. You can't do that. We perhaps can address a little later where bitachon comes in. But borrowing money that you don't know how you're going to repay, the Chafetz Chaim in Avos Chesed also speaks about this explicitly. He says, borrowing money where you don't know how you're going to repay is just not permissible. It's the same thing as hiring workers when you don't know how you can afford to pay them. It's the same idea.
Is there any distinction between borrowing from a Jew or a non-Jew, an individual, a corporation, a mortgage, credit card, gemach, a government loan, or do we not, when it comes to Hilchas Gezel, we don't distinguish?
You don't distinguish unless you're dealing with an agency that is lending out to people like you and has some kind of stipulation for people that can't repay. Certain government loans, for example, many of the student loans are taking into consideration the fact that there's a hope that students will one day make a living, but there's no way of knowing, and many default on their loans, and they have an apparatus for them. They have a payment schedule that's much lighter, something that's appropriate for people who have so much. You know, so there'll be a very big difference between taking a loan from someone that has the expectations that you're going to repay, or even an institution that has expectations that you're going to repay, versus taking a loan from either a government or some other setup where they understand that it is not certain that you're going to be able to repay at some kind of logical pace, and that you may end up having to pay at very small increments.
Uh-huh. Now, so what would be the EITSA if we're dividing up between pre-debt and post-debt, before getting into debt and after getting into debt, how to avoid?
Debt is to be avoided at all costs. Now, you have to remember, the way the world works, especially today, is the price of money. I remember I once approached somebody for a donation to my call at that time. And he tells me, he gave me a number, $9 or $10 million in debt. How can you approach me now? Then I spoke it over with somebody experienced, and he said, "Fool you are. You know, you're just so naive. How come you're not $9 million in debt? Because no one would give you $9 million of debt. The reason why he has $9 million of debt is because he has that much credit. The entire world today is based on the price of money. And obviously, it is worth it for him to borrow money because he's making so much more than what he's going to have to pay for. And, you know, go back to him and tell him people like you can afford to give to a yeshiva." In terms of business, you know, in terms of the business world, debt is nothing scary. You know, debt is the way you operate. It's the way, once again, you just have to make sure that your profit margin is always going to be so much better than the cost of the money. The money market is what the world is all about today. But when you're dealing with individuals, unless you're actually borrowing money to start a business, when you're dealing with individuals, it's not really that way. And you really have to avoid debt. The question is, what if it's just impossible? What if one finds that he just does not have the means to support his family? So, of course, you know, that's not something that can be perpetuated. If you realize that this is something temporary, someone is either getting an education, someone is beginning some venture, a family member is beginning something, and ultimately the hope is that there will be support, you know, that's fine. But if there's just no idea whatsoever, it's just a matter of accruing more and more debt, what's the answer for it between the Geneva and the Eves Kelev Bechevia, where you just turn yourself into someone needy? You know, eventually, what do you think? Society is going to have to take up a collection to help repay your debts. All of that is not right. All of this is absolutely not right. That's the idea of getting into it. You know, you have to find an answer. You can't say, okay, I'll borrow money and everything's going to be wonderful.
Right. So you get to the point that unfortunately somebody took on debt before listening to the show, and they have debts or something unusual happened and they needed to dip into debts. So an emergency came up and the debt is due. How does a debtor who doesn't have the funds to repay deal with the issue?
So first, let's talk about the Torah's idea. The Torah made Shmitas Ksafim. The idea of Shmitas Ksafim, once every 7 years, you know, all loans are absolved. But there's an interesting halacha there, Dvar HaShmita. What it is when the person comes to repay the debt, so you're supposed to tell him, Mishameh Dani, I am keeping Shmita, you don't have to pay me. And he has a mitzvah to say, Af Al Pi Kein, nevertheless, I'd like to repay. What's this game all about? The answer is, the Torah is not trying to say that every 7 years we start over again. What the Torah is saying is that when somebody just cannot take the burden of his debt, the Torah does not believe in bankruptcy. However, every seventh year, the Torah says that you have the option of choosing whether or not to take advantage of Shmitas Ksafim. Meaning, you owe money, you're supposed to be told Mishameh. You can afford to pay back, pay back. You can't afford to pay back, the Torah wants to allow you to start with a clean slate. Now, what is obvious, though, is that with time, you understand where your credit is going to stay. Or you understand that you can't go on doing this forever. People are not going to lend you money. I know there's an issur d'oraisa of not lending somebody money because you're afraid of Shmita. But in the case of somebody that is constantly relying on Shmita every 7 years, he's just doing away with all his debt, then ultimately, you know, this is not a person that's ever repaid a debt. And you are not required to lend money to someone who just never pays back.
Chazal also instituted a kruzbol because of these issues.
Now, then came kruzbol because people stopped lending. So for the sake of being able to get people to lend, they made kruzbol. So practically speaking, Shmitas Ksafim today is not really going to work until Mashiach comes because people are going to be relying on kruzbol. So we don't have the Torah's option. There is no alternative. There is no bankruptcy. In terms of the halachic status of a corporation, well, obviously, even if we don't recognize the concept of a legal person, limited liability is in halacha defined as a tnai shivamoma, meaning that this was the initial stipulation, that there was no personal responsibility, and then you're free. And then you're free if you incorporate and then borrow money, so the corporation owes the money and you don't. It's not a wise way to do business. You're not going to have people investing with you in the future if your corporation is constantly going bankrupt or your corporations are regularly going bankrupt. And of course, today you can't hide anything. You can't hide a thing. Everyone is going to know. You can rename it. You can change your name. There's no way of hiding anymore. Those days are over. So what happens when you're in debt? The first thing to do is stop your debt from growing. If you're talking about debt to an institution where you're paying interest, and obviously replacing it with a gemach makes so much more sense so that you're not accruing, you know, ridiculous amounts of debt just for interest. With regard to just your lifestyle, you've got to make sure that your debt isn't growing. You have to find an answer. You know, if it means somebody who wasn't working till now getting himself a job or getting a better job or just cutting down on his expenses, that's an absolute necessity. One cannot just constantly accrue debt and hope that he's going to pay back someday. Once you put a stop to it, then you can break it down. Gemachim, for example, where you can get longer term gemachim to smaller amounts from a few different gemachim, which makes it just livable. And then if you've changed your lifestyle and you really are capable of paying back, so you'll be able to do it. But to go from one to another and just allow the debt to keep piling up, you're just never going to repay. And what you're doing at a certain point, it becomes obvious that you're just playing game.
Right. So, but especially living in Israel, that there is a concept requirement when you were marrying off a child to buy an apartment. So you can get your debts under control and hopefully pay them off or be manageable and little amounts paid over time to gemach. But when you have this major requirement, financial outlay, or otherwise in certain, they say chugim, in certain areas, you're not going to be able to marry off your children. How do you handle an issue like that?
So number one, you'll be able to marry off your children. But if you want a certain quality of person, you know, for your daughter, you are going to have to spend the money that you don't have. How do you go about it? So A, if you have no idea where the money is going to come from, so the only alternative is bitachon. I just want to talk a minute or two about bitachon. Bitachon is not the simplistic answer to everything that we can deal with. Bitachon means you are holding in a place where it's so clear to you on the basis of experience. It is so clear to you that Hashem will not let you down, to the point that you don't ask the question. Which means that if you are asking the question and someone else has to answer bitachon, it doesn't work. You know, the Yerushalmis live with bitachon. For the most part, for generations, it worked. The Satmar Rav used to say there was a whole discussion of whether or not the Six-Day War was really miraculous. The Satmar Rav was on the side of it not being a miracle. It was the Sitra Achra. Building up the secular government or whatever. So the Satmar Rav made the comment, you don't have to look for miracles in Israel. The fact that every pauper in Mea Shearim, you know, marries off his 17 kids and gives each one of them a half an apartment, that is the greatest miracle on earth. Now, for these Yerushalmis, for generations it worked. It is not working for everybody today. There are so many terrible stories. There are so many terrible stories that the standard Yerushalmi thing was to borrow from one gemach and give to another gemach and give to another gemach and pay off a little here and pay off a little there. And once they marry off their kids, they sell their own apartment, pay off most of their debts, and then they're fine. Today, because the numbers are so astronomical, even selling their own apartment will not cover the amount that is necessary. So in many societies, they actually demand less. The kids no longer have to live in Yerushalayim. They're talking about moving out of town, or they're talking about buying an apartment for investment somewhere in some other city in Eretz Yisrael and renting in Israel and hoping that the rent will cover, renting in Yerushalayim and hoping that the rent will cover it. Nevertheless, if we're talking about a society where you want a quality person, you're going to put up a lot of money. The only way to do that is either that you don't ask the question because you're sure Hashem is going to help you and we've seen miracles, or if you're one of those people that really has a question, then you've got to have some kind of idea. Are you going to be able to do it? You're going to have some kind of idea, whether it's fundraising, if you want to do that, whether it is a job, investing, making sure that whoever you're doing the investing with knows what he's doing, getting yourself a good money manager. People that have a small amount of money can have a good money manager that will turn that into a much larger sum of money. There's got to be a plan. Part of it is putting away money when your kids are born. Putting away money when kids are born, these big gemachim, where people that puts them on their feet. It's possible to marry off a child that way. It doesn't cover everything, but you're not starting from scratch. You're not starting from nothing. Another very important thing is today when people buy apartments. So the price of apartments are often astronomical. The down payment here was always for so much more. Now you can put down a smaller down payment. And instead of a 20-year mortgage, you get a 30-year mortgage. And people don't think. 30-year mortgage means that you're going to be paying mortgage and marrying off your kids at the same time. You've got to think ahead. Unless you have some way of making that happen, a 30-year mortgage is not something you can take on. So, bottom line, you've got to think ahead. So unless you really have that bitachon, you may have to settle for someone that is not a member of the society or of the quality that you're looking for. The one thing is that when you're dealing with chutznik families, often, even though the Rosh Yeshiva told the bachur, listen, you're so kosher, anything less than 700,000 shekel, you just don't go for. The parents may be a lot more understanding, and they may like you from a chutanin and actually settle for less. You know, there is some hope on that side. But unless you've set something up, unless you have some way of knowing where the money is going to come from, unless you have family that's willing to support, or you're willing to do fundraising and you know how to do fundraising, you have room to fundraise off, unless you really have that, you can't just go borrowing money. That again, we're talking about Geneva.
So this begs the bigger question. Maybe this is exactly the point you're discussing. Is there a certain point that you're not allowed to take on debt? Is there a halachically too much debt that is above the line or below the line?
Too much debt is debt where you have no clue whatsoever as to where it's coming from. Not even a clue, not the beginnings of an idea of where it's going to come, of how you're going to pay it back.
So if it's al piteva, somebody's not going to be able to pay it back?
Unless someone is the Balbi talking that I described before. So as far as he's concerned, he doesn't have this question. He's not doing Geneva because he knows Hashem's going to repay for it. But it's got to be someone that is so sure. And he lives his life that way. And Hashem helps these people.
Okay, so let's assume somebody needs to take on some debt. Emergency comes up for whatever reason, and they are going to a gemach or going to a bank, a lender, a friend. But they already have 2 loans, 3 loans, 8 loans out, and already having a difficult time with the debt coverage there, covering that debt. Is there a duty, kumvase, an act of duty to disclose the debts that somebody already has when he's about to receive another loan from somebody? Is there an issue of genevis das here, or is this not something that you have to actively disclose in the absence of the lender requesting that information?
Only if there's an assumption that this is your first loan, if you gave them that impression. But otherwise, because debt is so much part of the society here, people take nothing for granted. There's no reason why anyone should think that you have no other debt.
Okay, so the burden would be on the lender to ask that question. And then if they ask, you'd have to disclose accurately.
Yes. You cannot in any way get someone to lend you money or certainly give you money under you know, false pretenses.
Right. Let's say somebody is learning in Kollel, and it gets to the level that Baruch Hashem, he has 2 kids, 3 kids, 4 kids, and now they can't make ends meet. I think he's got to go out and get a job at this point. What's the etzah there?
Listen, everyone's another situation. Everybody's a different situation. It is definitely something that has to be considered and something that has to be discussed, I mean, in depth with whoever the person looks to for guidance, and I would hope it's a level-headed human being. There are some people that needs to happen to. There are some people that call so need so badly that others may suggest you're learning and maybe help them. But there's got to be an answer. It cannot be that a person just remains there. Although the halacha is like Beis Din can't force you to go to work to pay your debt. That's for Beis Din. As far as yourself, what right do you have, you know, not to repay debts? You owe people the money. even you know, aside from the geneva aspect, a priest b'chol mitzvah, you know, you spend money on araminim, you got to spend money on repaying your debts too. A person really has to take responsibility. Being irresponsible and just saying, "Oh, I just love learning, and Hashem will take care of me," it must be done with some kind of cheshbon. I am not going to go make any sweeping statements. I definitely feel that someone has to see to it that he's speaking things over with whoever he looks to for guidance, and that hopefully we're dealing with somebody who's level-headed. Level-headed people are allowed to make exceptions. But when someone level-headed, I mean somebody who understands the difference between being irresponsible or someone making a sacrifice to Shem Shemayim. There are many situations of people that were sitting and learning and only took a position because they needed to for Parnassa. And Baruch Hashem, they took on a position because they're serving quality soul in ways that they weren't before. I'm not belittling sitting and learning, but they've become mashpim in a very, very big way. I have personally encouraged different people when Parnassa hit. I said that was a sign from heaven that this is the time for you to start giving. And Baruch Hashem, it's done so much for them. You know, I'm talking about people that have want to give, just preferred learning. I mean, everyone loves learning. Aside from, of course, there was another factor as well. And I think that also has to be spoken out, which is that there are times that people are sitting and learning and Parnassa is very difficult, but they keep up with it because they're learning very well. And the house is, there's electricity. You know, the house is alive and they feel there's a real mysterious advantage. This is what we're doing it for and it's worth it. And then after years of learning, you know, people often, if they're not in a position of hashpa or where they're teaching others or guiding others, they start slowing down a little bit. And then the idealism is gone. And then you start feeling that same Parnassa crunch that was over there, that was always there, but you never really felt it before because you were so alive in your learning. That's another time where it's time to move on and really start being mashpia. Now, I'm taking for granted that the issue is, can you learn or be mashpia? Of course, there are times that people owe so much money that they may have to leave Kodesh altogether and find themselves a way of making much bigger money. Again, this is not something that is discussed on a community level. This is something that's discussed on an individual level. Someone has to see to it that he's getting guidance from a qualified manhig, someone who knows him, understands the circumstances, would be able to judge what's necessary for Klal Yisrael, what's necessary for him, what's right. Will be creative if necessary. I'm not going to make some kind of sweeping statement telling people at any stage to go close the gemaras.
Absolutely, absolutely. Last question, Rabbi Berkowitz, for you, and I appreciate all the time. Talking about use of debt and more generally fiscal responsibility, should we, and if so, how do we teach our children about these concepts?
In America, they used to teach kids to save money, the concept of saving money. I know the Yerushalmis make fun of it. They used to say that the other day a kid's born, they teach him to put money in a piggy bank and save money. Like, you know, that's the most important thing. But at the same time, there's something to it. There's definitely something to it. But certainly as kids, you know, as teenagers, one way or another, they receive or earn money. We must train them to use it responsibly. We must explain to them at the youngest age to use it responsibly. One of the biggest problems is that there is no chinuch for living responsibly. So many newlyweds accrue debt, ridiculous amounts of debt, before they really have major expenses, only because no one ever taught them how to live. You know, they know what their parents buy. They forgot the fact that their parents didn't buy those things as newlyweds and didn't buy those things until they made a comfortable living. And here they are, you know, spending as if they're earning big money. And meanwhile, they're being supported. And, you know, especially if they have no experience and no training, and then you give them a credit card, that'll work so long as you're willing to give them a credit card. But once that stops, they're not going to do it. They're not going to know what to do with themselves. Children have to be trained to be responsible. You have to talk to them about it before they're married, on not spending more money than they have, and even saving money.
Living on a budget.
Today in the seminaries, they are teaching this. They actually have class on. They brought Mesilai in a lot of places, and they're actually teaching in the seminaries. I really wish that there would be some way to do that in yeshiva. Obviously, it's not going to become part of the curriculum. The assumption yeshiva is you learn Gemara and everything else you've got to do on your own. But there, it should at least be made available. You know, not that kids should be thinking, or yeshiva bachurim should be thinking about money all day, but that they should learn what responsibility is.
So Mesila is actively going into the schools, not even being reactive once people are in.
Going to the schools and teaching, and it really does a lot. It really, really does a lot.
Right, terrific. Rabbi Berkowitz, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure. And I look forward to next time.
Same here.
Thank you so much.
That's luck in everything you do.
Amen. Thank you. Joining us now is Rabbi Yosef Greenwald. Rabbi Greenwald is a Rav in the Muncie area. He is a well-known Dayan in New York, and he also served as a Dayan for many years in Yerushalayim and Givat Zev as well. He's also a popular lecturer, an author, and Rabbi Greenwald, we are delighted to have you with us here today.
The pleasure is mutual. Thank you for having me on.
Amen, amen. So, Rabbi Greenwald, I'd like to divide up our discussion in three different areas, all relating to debt. And the first area is going to be taking on of debt and the various halachas in that regard. And next will be debt repayment, once you have to pay it back. And then third, to me, is probably maybe the most important area, certainly to me the most interesting, is elimination of debt. Are there halachic ways that we can eliminate debt, get out of debt, for example? Mm-hmm. Are there excuses to get out of it? So that'll be our trajectory. So just starting out with taking on debt, I think a very common shaila that comes up is somebody takes on debt when he can still afford to pay off the debt and something happens. For example, Rachman Litzlan, he loses his job. Corona hits and his income goes down, whatever it may be. And now he cannot afford to pay off his debt. Is that an excuse? Can he go back? And halachically, does he have a right to tell the lender, I'm not able to pay back, or we're going to have to rejigger my payment schedule because things have changed for me unexpectedly?
So I think what we would have to do is we'd have to break that down as always, Kedarka Shatayra, we'll have to break that down into a few separate ideas. One idea is to realize that, on the one hand, this is going to sound a bit forbidding before we say the Tzad Hakula. Debt is never negotiable. That means like this. What do I mean to say? Of course, there's negotiations between a lender and a borrower, but debt is not a moral imperative of, well, if it works for me, if I have it, you know, if it fits in, so then I'll pay. Debt is a halachic reality. The Gemara does use the terminology of mitzvah lefroya choiv. Piroyin choiv is a mitzvah, the Gemara ksuba staf pezayin, but really the Gemara, in many places in Shas, understands that the obligation to pay back a choiv is what's called mamoni gabok. That means if I owe somebody $100, he, so to speak, has, we would call in English, a lien. It's not just a lien on property that if I sell, he could claim that from the lekuchos, from the buyers. It's more than that. That means that $100 is a reality of money that's his by me. To the point, just to illustrate where that plays itself out in halacha, Chazal, in the beginning of Perek Ezu Neshech, understand that if somebody is to walk into a court of law, a bezdin, and not be straight up about debt that's owed, even if he has no plans on not paying it indefinitely, but right now he doesn't want to be in the hot seat, you know, he wants to relieve himself of the pressure dealing with it right now, the Gemara sees that as an act of theft. Because to put on the table in Besdin that I don't owe somebody $100 when I do is really denying a reality, which is the same reality as removing a car from somebody's garage, which everybody understands is Gneva. Removing a Choyv from being legally viable is also Gneva. A Choyv is real money. And that Mamani Gaboch creates a halakhic imperative. So that's not negotiable. Now, practically, how's that going to play itself out in terms of repayment? That we'll have to discuss, like you're saying. That's really the second topic. But as far as the idea of the shibud is concerned, that if I owe somebody money, my house, my car, my bank accounts, my portfolio are all mishubadim to the person that I owe money to, that's not negotiable.
So when you mention a shibud, that's in legal terms a security interest. The borrower has given a security interest to the lender and his assets. Does that give the does that limit the borrower in what he can do with his assets? He cannot spend certain amounts, he can't sell off certain assets, or does that not leave him with any limitations?
Okay, that's another very crucial point. I would just maybe correct the definition of security is more consistent with the idea of a mashkin. A mashkin is something specifically designated. If I do a business deal with somebody and there's $50 million on the line and I designate a large property that I have as collateral on that loan, since it was designated specifically, that would be more consistent with security. But in terms of that, if I owe somebody any amount of money, be it for groceries or for a business deal, the fact of the matter is that everything I own is mishubit. Would it be, I think what you're asking is, would it be wrong for me to spend without regard as to his choiv? Poskim even discuss the legality / morality of a person buying himself a lulav and esrig where he owes somebody money. You could be yaitzah with somebody else's lulav and esrig, but you certainly can't be yaitzah peroin choiv by paying with somebody else's money. So, yes, there definitely is a right and a wrong of where and how a person is allowed to and mechuyev to spend his money if he has debt sitting on his shoulders.
So in that regard, can the borrower send his kids off to camp? Is that something that's viewed as volitional that he shouldn't be spending on? Or is that something that's viewed as a need? Is that the distinction between what you can pay on and what you can't, needs versus wants? Where's the line there?
So, as soon as we veer into practical, what a person is allowed to spend, what not to spend, we have to make a very important point. And that is that there's a large body of discussions called Misadra Lebal Chayiv and Shulchan Aruch. It's extensive. We try to avoid it, using a technical, Bezdin doesn't want to, and I don't think people particularly want to have their lives intruded in. There is a halacha, Siman Shulchan Aruch, that allows Bezdin to literally set up a person's finances. On every penny you spend, groceries, what you're allowed to buy, clothing, it's very intrusive and it's very debilitating for a person to be treated that way. Most often, Bezdin very strongly encourages a person to come, two people to come to terms and make a payment plan that works for both of them. Now, the specifics of can I marry off my daughter if I have debt on me? Can I send my children to camp? There's very often not a black and white answer to that, because a lot of needs are relative. A lot of needs are relative to the particulars, emotional, what the family's used to. What one person's luxuries is somebody else's necessity. So it's very hard to give exact answers to that. Suffice it to say, there is a siman in Shulchan Aruch that allows for Bezdin to really clamp down and lay down penny by penny how a family should spend money when it's debt on them. We try to avoid that at all costs because it's really a debilitating system to go into.
Right. So going back to taking on debt, is there a limit, a halachic limit? And we're talking halachically, and maybe you have to answer in hashkafa, a limit on the amount of debt that somebody can or should take on.
So I think here we have to answer, we have to define two separate halachas, both of which are important. One is a concept that the Pesach can bring down. The Gemara defines with a pasuk. Shlomo HaMelech says that a person doesn't pay debt. Lo yivarosha v'lo yishalim. Defines him as a rasha. A rasha, by the way, doesn't mean an evil person. A rasha means somebody who's not living up to his obligations. What Shlomo HaMelech is talking about, and it's important to make this distinction, is somebody who incurred legal debt and now doesn't have, if he doesn't have the wherewithal, if he's an oinus, he's an oinus. Somebody who's negligent or somebody who's trying to fudge his way out of paying in a timely fashion. That's defined as levi rosh leishan. I think it's important to be magdin that there's a whole nother halacha at play here, which goes into, like we said before, about denying a choiv in Bezdin. There's another form of thievery, what's flat out gneva, and that is if a person misrepresents what he's doing with the money, what his financial reality is, how much previous debt he has. If a person takes money from somebody under false pretenses, a halva that's given from Reuven to Shimon is not just a gift, it's a transaction. Reuven gives Shimon $100 of his own in return for Shimon being a meshubid to the tune of $100 to repay Reuven. What happens if the transaction, so to speak, the halva, is based on false pretenses? Reuven would never lend Shimon money if he knew that he had $250,000 pre-existing debt. Shimon misrepresented his books. So then Reuven gave his money. It's the same thing as a Mekach Toz. Same idea as Reuven selling Shimon a car, which is supposedly in good working condition, and really the transmission is shot. The same thing is true if I'm giving you a halva, supposedly because you're on sound financial footing. You represented only that it's a great investment opportunity. You want to borrow money from me. And really, you're sinking into quicksand and you have 20 people that are after you for chovis that you already owe. That misrepresentation defines that the money I gave you was shaloi bidaiti, it's an ekatos. And that money is illegally held. And the playing field, when somebody's holding on to money as a gneva, as opposed to when somebody's holding on to money as a halva, which, despite the obligation, still a halva, is a totally different playing field. I'll illustrate. There is a lav in the Torah le'sila kenosha. If we know, if I know that somebody owes me $1,000, and right now Nebuchadnezzar doesn't have the wherewithal to pay, legitimately, it's fallen on hard times, family, there's a child not well, etc., etc., etc. For me to hound him is a lav deraisa. Ad kedei kach, I'm fond of saying over story, Reb Chaim Brisker would avoid walking to shul, his own shul, in town of Brisk, in a straightforward way. He took a very out-of-the-way route in order to avoid walking past the house of a certain person who owed him money. He knew the person didn't have the money. He felt that even walking by the person's house, just them seeing his face would be emotionally debilitating. And he had a chash that was a lav of lesir lekenosha. Now, the Torah, that means that the Torah says when things are on the up and up, there's an emotional chiyuv to take away that, to not add insult to injury. That's the lav of lesir lekenosha. But that's based on money which was legitimately lent. Money which was lent under misrepresentations, gneva. I'm allowed to call down the sheriff, so to speak, to go to Beis Din when somebody owes me money for gneva. There's no lav l'sila kenosha on gneva. So I think that's very important in defining, you know, how what the obligations are.
Right. So let's go back to that point of the duty to disclose or the failure to disclose, because there's a difference there. You were talking about if somebody actively, falsely discloses information about his wherewithal to be able to pay back debts, that would be a Genevis Nas or a Gezel Mamish. How about the failure to disclose somebody's inability to repay? The lender doesn't ask, and the borrower knows that the lender would want to have this information, but he doesn't disclose it. In certain circumstances, that's also brought down as Genevis Das by the postgame. So how about in the lending context? Would that be a Genevis Das, the failure to actively disclose one's inability to pay?
That's a great question. I think that distinction, you know, is something that plays itself out. Shiduchim. There are certain things which you're withholding. There are certain things that even if they weren't specifically asked, it's clear that this is something that the person, this is on anybody's list to ask, right? If you didn't ask, it's just by accident. There are certain things which are very subjective. So if the person didn't ask, okay, you don't have to answer. That's not called misleading. What the cutoff point in that is a very, very selective definition. It's very subjective. I think the same is true by Mekach Tos. I'm selling somebody a car. If the transmission is about to die, I think that's basic information. If I don't, that's not called a omission inadvertently. You didn't ask me. I didn't have to offer. A car without a transmission, we'd say in Lumdis, is not in Yeshivas, is not a cheftz of a car, as simply put as that. A car that maybe the radio and the stereo don't work that well. No, you know. If you want, go into the car and turn it on. You don't need to be a mechanic to turn on the stereo. If you didn't, it's probably because you don't care all that much. And I think we could use that same example over here also. If it's something that a person doesn't ask, but it's a double pashut, that affects the basic reality of the ability to live to pay, I think that not submitting that to the malva is, he'd be guilty of omission.
Very good. So one of the major klalim in debt, taking on debt, if somebody knows or he thinks he's not going to be able to repay, he can't borrow the money. I want to define, and I want to, if you could help us define, what does that mean? I don't think I'll be able to repay, or I think I can't repay, or what does that mean that somebody believes he won't be able to pay when taking on debt? What if he thinks maybe I'll get a salary raise and then I'll be able to pay the debt back, or I'll think I'll be able to pay it back if I win the lottery? If I get a gift, if only we can cut our expenses, I know I'll be able to repay the loan I'm about to take. Well, what does that mean that you don't think you'll be able to repay it so you can't take the loan?
I think that's very subjective. You know, there are two extremes. I'm hoping I'm going to win the lottery, You know, maybe I'll buy Psicha to Geshem this year, and, you know, that'll pull me over the top. I don't think that's legitimate. On the other hand, you know, this is my salary. This is my wife's salary. We think we could put away a certain amount of our salary to repay that loan. You know, you never know what life is going to, life always throws a person curveballs. So you never know what's going to come a person's way. But legitimately, this is what we looks like. I think that's okay. What the gray area between those two is a good question. I think it's very subjective. Wishful thinking is a very gray area in a person's life. And like everything else, you know, a person has to be able to be honest.
Right. So let's move on to debt repayment. The debt was not repaid on time. The borrower is in default. And the creditor knocks on his door and the borrower says, "Ainley, I don't got the funds, sorry." What recourse does the creditor have, in particular, if he doesn't believe the borrower is still paying a lease on two expensive luxury cars and sending the kids to camp and whatever other luxuries that he indulges in. He goes out to dinner three times a week to expensive steak restaurants. So what can the creditor do at this point to collect, or to, even if he's not collecting, at least initially to validate the claim by the borrower that he doesn't have the funds to repay?
Interesting you use the terminology ainli, because that exactly is the nusach that the goyim use to institute a shvu, which does not exist deraisa. Deraisa, if a malvus tevei aloyven, aloyven says ainli, so we don't find such a shvua. Go prove it. Burden of proof is on who? If you want to be mitzi mamon, the golden rule mid deraisa is, now the one who wants to be Maitzi Mamon has to prove it. He's going to have Eidim that he does have the funds. He's going to have to locate the funds and so on and so forth. The Goinim, you're talking probably about 1,000 years ago, maybe 1,100 years ago, instituted that a Malva, where there's some type of basic smoking gun, doesn't have to be major evidence, but where there's some type of legitimate tvia on the Malva's part that the Loiva is withholding assets, he's been transferring to an offshore account, he's been funneling funds to various family members. You know, this happens all the time, unfortunately. He has a right to be tevei shvua. Now, we don't actually administer shvua bizman hazeh. That's the meaning over the last few hundred years, is that we don't administer in Bezdin Shavuos. And Memela, what we do in lieu of the ability, the bargaining power that a Shavuos holds, is we will force, if we could get a Malvin Aloyva into Bezdin, we'll force some type of pshara. What Bezdin can do, if Bezdin does see legitimate evidence that Aloyva's ainli is not on the up and up, Bezdin will force what they call today's legal world discovery. And that's definitely a tool that that Bezdin uses.
Okay, so Bezdin will insist that the borrower turn over financial documents, bank statements, brokerage statements, all correct, of those. And if the borrower refuses, then he's held in contempt of Bezdin.
He's held in contempt of Bezdin. And Bezdin can then use their own judgment to impose a payment plan, yeah?
Uh-huh, interesting. So Bezdin comes in and they see that this borrower has a house and it's got a low mortgage, no mortgage, and he has other assets, whatever they may be. He's got a nice set of sterling silver cutlery that's used for Shabbos, a special one for Yontif, various assets in the house. He has a brokerage account that has Apple stock in it, 10,000 shares. What can the Bezdin force the lender to sell in order to pay off his debts?
Theoretically, anything. Practically, how that plays itself out is a matter of judgment. Again, there is a siman in Shulchan Aruch, Misadin Lebal Choyv, it's very technical, and Bezdin can use that to actually impose law and order on a creditor's, you know, on a person who's in debt's assets. We try not to. But on a theoretical level, we're in terms of the concept of shibud, that shibud is on the cutlery and it's on the brokerage account and it's on the house and the bungalow and the cars and so on and so forth. Yes.
So halachically, the borrower can be obligated to sell his personal residence. And under bankruptcy law, there is a safe harbor. Under secular law, there would be a safe harbor. We see that the halacha then seems to take debt repayment more seriously than the secular law.
Halacha sees debt repayment, like we used the concept before, Mamoni Gaboch. I'll illustrate how far the Nesivis, one of the classic Mepharshim Chayshim Mishpat, points out that when you're talking about debt repayment, if somebody owes me $1,000 and he designates a, I don't know what, a power lawnmower to be used as Paroyan Chayv, let's say, I don't even have to make a Maaser Kinyan on that power lawnmower. It automatically becomes mine because I have an outstanding Chatzi Kinyan in all of his assets. As soon as he designates something specifically, it becomes mine. So if we look at it that way, then debt repayment is not a subjective, well, certain things yes, certain things not, your personal, again, Misadrin Labalchoy Bezin does have to leave out basic living needs. And a roof over one's head might include that, but who says you can't rent? The fact that it's your personal residence, we see that as assets, not as a person's house is not necessarily himself. So right, even if you have to leave over basic foodstuffs and clothing and a roof over and beds and bedding and so on and so forth, he doesn't have to own that house. He could move into the basement and rent out the top floor, you know?
Right, right. What we've been talking about in general about a lender or borrower. What if the lender is a non-Jew, non-Jewish individual, a non-Jewish corporation, a credit card company decides we're going to go to Beis Din and we're going to collect our debt via the Beis Din process. It's more effective, more efficient. What would go through the mind of a Beis Din when looking at who the creditor is, the lender is in front of them? Would they distinguish between a Jewish lender, a non-Jewish lender, a corporation, an LLC? Would that make any difference?
So what you're bringing up is really should be divided into three or four topics. Does debt taken on with a corporation, LLC, et cetera, does that change the reality of the debt? Is that debt then not to be considered halachically a personal debt? Somebody owns a company. The company borrowed money. Is that his personal loan? That's a very good question, but that's a general halachic topic. Whenever you're talking about corporations, is the assets or conversely, the debt of the corporation, is that the person who owns the corporation? It's a good question. It's negeya ribis, negeya chometz in terms of ownership on Pesach. It's negeya employers and employees that are working on Shabbos and so on. So that's really a loaded topic. Maybe we'll leave that on the side. Whether we can factor in secular law to define the agreement between a Jew and a non-Jew, that obviously the terms of agreement between them were kafuf, we would use the term, submissive to secular law, is a very good question. The pashtus is that yes, if there's an agreement, a business agreement between somebody Jewish and somebody non-Jewish, normally we understand that the terms of agreement and the resultant obligation / shibud between the two parties have to be consistent with secular law. So Bezin can take that into account.
But what will they take into account? Meaning if there's a lender, a non-Jewish lender, and under halachic law, strict halacha, the Beis Din can force the debtor to sell his personal residence. But under secular law, if you went to a secular court, they would not do such a thing. Even through a bankruptcy process, there would be a safe harbor on the personal residence of the borrower. So what happens if there's a non-Jewish lender that says, I'm going to be able to collect
It could very well be that Bezin will take that into account. And I think the precedent for that is the famous truth of Reb Moshe, where he says in Chelik Bezin Chesh Mishpat, that bankruptcy law, Reb Moshe's Chiddush, is that bankruptcy law is binding on two parties even when they're both Jewish. When they come into Bezin, if one party had declared personal bankruptcy, that personal bankruptcy, being that in secular law, you can't hound somebody who's in personal bankruptcy for debts that he owes. So then that would be true lahalacha as well. Even if you don't hold Reb Moshe, what you're disagreeing with Reb Moshe, many places can disagree with Reb Moshe, is because they don't feel that when two Jews enter a business agreement, they're submitting themselves adaita dehochi. But a Jew and a non-Jew, certainly there's an adaita dehochi of being bound by the mores of secular law. So Bezin definitely will take that into account, yes.
Okay, so now we're getting into our third segment, elimination of debt. So according to Rav Moshe, we do have an ability for a debtor, if it fits within the secular law requirements of following bankruptcy, to file for bankruptcy. And according to Rav Moshe, that would eliminate the debt, certainly against a non-Jewish party, but even against a Jewish party, that debt would be eliminated. Would a Beis Din, how do they think about that concept of you filed bankruptcy, and I guess thereafter the creditor sues the debtor who filed bankruptcy in a secular court, and then the lender wants to sue him in a Beis Din to try to collect. How would a Beis Din, practically speaking, deal with that? Would they say it's already in secular court, we can't touch it, there's Rav Moshe's Shita, or would they litigate? Would they hear the case and say we don't adhere to Rav Moshe, many posts can disagree? What would happen practically in this situation?
practically, it's hard to say. If something's in a secular court, it's very hard. Then the Bezin very often won't take it on because the teeth that Bezin has in the Epsokin is based on an arbitration agreement. If something's already in court, you can't really send it to arbitration legally. So the Bezin very often won't accept even such a case. The Bezin, as a dayan, we can rule on such a case. We can say the right thing. But to actually create a binding case out of it, very often not. So, you know, practically speaking, it doesn't usually present itself as such. You want to know if somebody had business, you know, a person had declared business bankruptcy, can he then be personally responsible, according to Ramesha? Or let's say even if somebody had declared personal bankruptcy, according to Ramesha, you will then not be able to seize assets. Ramesha says, Ad kedei kach, Ramesha says that debt is no longer outstanding. If Shimon seizes assets for Reuven, keneged hachoyv, and after Reuven had already declared a legally binding bankruptcy, if secular law declares that seizure of assets to be non-binding, then that's Allah will have to conform to that. Ramesha understands that when two yidden enter a business agreement, they're binding themselves by the dynamic of business law that's to be found. He understands that as part of Dina de Malchus Dino. Many places can disagree. If I'm borrowing from somebody $2,000, I would say, befrat, if I borrow from somebody informally, like sort of in a gemach setting, from somebody $5,000, am I making an agreement with that person in consistency with local bankruptcy laws? You know, it's many paiskim disagree with Ramesha. If you'll go with the other paiskim, so then Bezin can and will disregard that bankruptcy. Now, Bezin's not going to want to go head to head with the secular law because again, the arbitration agreement will then not be enforceable. So, right. You know, there's a lot of chokhmah necessary in a Bezin setting strategically what to do in such a case.
Right. So let's talk elimination of debt. Let's talk elimination of debt short of bankruptcy. So the debtor is not in bankruptcy yet. The creditor attempts to collect. And then the debtor says, but there's a statute of limitations in the United States and probably under other countries as well. Each state has a statute of limitations that if the creditor didn't make an attempt to collect on the debt for a certain amount of time, 3 years, 4 years, whatever it may be, there's a statute of limitations and the creditor can no longer collect. Would we say Rav Moshe would also adhere to Minhag HaSochrim, that is the Minhag and that's Adat al-Hachi, that they entered into their agreement with that and Dina d'Malchus HaDin applies. So what would Rav Moshe say of the statute of limitations?
Good question. Truth of the matter is that I don't know. Rav Moshe didn't write on statute of limitations. Good question. It's a legitimate tzorchiyun. It's not muchach. One doesn't necessarily prove the other. It's quite possible Ramesha would hold statute of limitations apply. Statute of limitations, as far as strict black and white Shulchan Aruch is concerned, is discussed. But it's not discussed in terms of us imposing the statute of limitations. It's discussed in terms of, does a person, is there an umdina that after a certain amount of time, it's obviously you are moichel the choiv, or that you are miyayish from the choiv. That's discussed extensively by the Poskim HaChosh Mishpat Sim Tzadik Ches. The halacha is that there is no yish, there's no mechila on a chayv. The one chayv that we do find is a gemara, the end of ksubas, that says if a woman's not toiveya her ksuba from her husband for 25 years, there's a statute of limitations, but the rationale behind that is that a woman's ksuba is not a business arrangement. It's a domestic arrangement. It's a part of the chayv of a husband supporting his wife. It's a chayv as issues, not a chayv as moment in principle. So that's why it might be different than a regular choyv. The regular choyv is not subject to alpi halacha, the statute of limitations. Again, you bring up what Ramesha would do with that. That's a good question.
Right, right. So we have options of elimination of debt is bankruptcy, according to Ramesha, possibly an argument on the statute of limitations. Are there any other possibilities? And I'll give you an example. If somebody really doesn't have the money and he goes and has his accountant to write up his P&L and his assets, gives his balance sheet and he shows I owe $100,000 to a certain lender and I have $13,000 and I'm disclosing all of my assets. As long as you accurately disclose what you have, I would think that there's no problem in getting into a negotiation and eliminating the debt through an open discussion of the ability to pay. So that would seem to be like a negotiation. As long as you're accurate in your disclosure, that would be an acceptable way to eliminate debt as long as the creditor agrees to it.
That would be acceptable halacha if the malva is willing to, and this has to be bepemole. He has to verbally and sign that he's being moichel the rest of the debt in order to get the proverbial, you know, bird in his hand instead of the two in the bush? Can he do that? Can he say, okay, so I'll be Meichel the rest? You can do that. Is there an automatic assumption that if somebody negotiates or he has a negotiated settlement sort of forced on him of a quarter to the dollar and so on and so forth, is that Meichiach? Is that an umdina that he was Meichel? No. That means I'm taking what I could get right now. You know, I hope that you turn things around and your business starts flourishing. And I have no intention of, if in 5 years you're doing better, I can't hound you on money you don't have, let's say like Ganesha. But if you're doing better in 5 years, there's no reason for me not to ask for that money. Unless I was Moichel B'Pe Male.
Now, what does that Moichel B'Pe Male mean? For example, if the borrower in the payment on a check says on it, payment in full in the memo line, and the lender cashes that check, is that a mechila? Let's say he saw it. Let's say he saw that payment in full. He wants the money. He doesn't want to be mochel, but he cashed it.
It's a good question. I never thought about it, to be honest. It's a good question. I'm not convinced that that would be a mechila. That could be just a standardized nusach. And as a general rule, like everything else in life, when you use standardized text, it doesn't mean that it's more than just a standardized nusach. So it doesn't necessarily mean a mechila. Whether that would be binding, I don't know. It's a good question.
So Rabbi Grimwald, let me ask you one last question. Do people ask shailas about these issues, debt repayment, debt elimination, or these the, and if they do, what are they asking? And if they don't, why aren't they asking?
You know, that's a loaded question. I'll try to answer you briefly. Unfortunately, as a general, which Rabbi Yishai already lamented many, many years ago, that people ask questions about all sorts of things. But Ehrlichkeit in business is something that unfortunately people don't ask about enough. And that's what we're doing on this show. We're trying to raise awareness of the choiv, the obligation to ask questions. What I do find is people do ask questions in another direction, and it's legitimate. People want to know, when they're balancing personal obligations, where does that fit in with Hilchus Tzedakah? All of us, you know, we're Jews. We all want to be generous. We all want to give as much as we can. Baruch Hashem, Yidden are givers. That's who we are. That's the air we breathe. At the same time, does that mean that we should be compromising on financial obligations, paying full tuition, that type of thing? People do ask, and unfortunately, there's no easy answers. You know, every situation is subjective. You really have to weigh up the pros and cons. But yes, people do have to bear in mind that personal financial obligations do come in many ways before other mitzvahs that we would like to do. But we have to understand that when we owe money, that money is not necessarily ours. That money legally is mechuyev, meshubed, to another party. And that's an important concept to ingrain in ourselves.
Right, right, very important. Rabbi Grunwald, I'd like to thank you for joining us. Really appreciate all the insights that you've given us.
A pleasure. We should be zeichet to celebrate the next Yom Yerushalayim Yer HaKadosh.
We look forward to having you. Joining us now is Naftali Horowitz. Naftali is a managing director at JP Morgan, quite a massive investment bank. He has over 25 years of experience in advising high net worth individuals, their families, nonprofits on financial stability and investments, finances in general. He also spends a good amount of time on charitable activities, including advising people, newlyweds, people who have been married for 20, 30 years. It doesn't matter. On financial issues as well. And he also recently published the book put out by Ark Scroll, You Revealed, A Torah Path to a Life of Success. I have read the book and genuinely enjoyed it. Naftali, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ari, for having me.
It's a pleasure. So Naftali, this is about debt. We could talk about a lot of things with you, and I hope we'll have you back in the future. I'm even saying that before we start, but why don't we focus, obviously, on debt, because that's the theme of our show. And I want to ask you in particular, we've had a lot of conversations on the show about more of the specifics of debt and getting out of debt, the halachas of debt. But I want to take a step back and more look at the forest and say, what do you think the underlying causes for the buildup of debt that has become so prevalent in society today? Is it people simply have a lot of availability of credit? Is it people not taking financial responsibility? Or is there a lot more going on here at this point?
It depends on the situation, obviously. There are many causes to build up of debt. You said the magic word, availability. Generations ago, you can borrow money from your next door neighbor. you can borrow money from a relative, but that's where it stopped. Today, banks, credit card companies are making debt so accessible to the average person. We also have a proliferation of gemachs, which, you know, they're meaning, they're well-intentioned, they mean well, but unfortunately, I've had people come to me with $200,000 to $250,000 of gemach loans. I can't even begin to imagine, yes, those numbers are not exaggerated.
And that's just from the gemachs. That's just from the gemachs.
Spreadsheets full of gemach loans. And they were paying back one gemach loan with another gemach loan, and they were literally building a Ponzi scheme, a pyramid, which ultimately always collapses upon them. Many instances where I've helped people speak to gemachs one after another. It takes years and years to get out of it. It takes years and years to get into it. But there's a tremendous amount of availability. People are rolling zero interest rate credit cards, one into the other, home equity lines of credit, and so on and so forth. So I think the first issue is availability. I think the second issue is that people are not afraid of debt. They used to be afraid of debt, and they're no longer afraid of debt. They don't have that fear factor. I was speaking to a client yesterday and just demonstrating the difference between swiping a credit card and the pain or lack of pain factor that's involved in that versus taking cash out of your wallet. And the further away you get from cash, the less it's going to feel like you're actually spending money. When you're living off of a credit card or any kind of loan, even a check is not as painful to write as it is to take out 360 cash dollars from your pocket and pay it. The Rabbanu Shalom gave us a certain aversion to parting with money, but that aversion does not extend to forms of credit. And therefore, it's not a big deal when you start borrowing and you don't even realize how it creeps up on you. So those are definitely two things where people don't really, they're not afraid to borrow money. And there's two types of debt. Maybe we'll talk about that later. There's good debt and there's bad debt. But most of the debt that gets people in trouble is bad debt. And this is what you're seeing today. And people are living lives on other people's money, or they're borrowing from the future to pay for the present.
Right. I definitely want to get back to that point of good debt versus bad debt, because that's an unconventional way to frame things. I guess maybe we'll talk about it right now. I would think that bad debt is like credit card debt, unless you're using it for a good business purpose. Bad debt, a good debt could be education loans or maybe something like that, or a business loan that's going to get you into a positive business. How would you define what is bad debt? What is good debt? How did we find each? And maybe is there a limit in the amount of debt? If it's good, maybe is it unlimited we can take, or does that at a certain point become bad debt when it becomes maxed out as well?
Let's give you some of the factors that I believe are going to be inherent in good debt. First of all, good debt is generally debt that is used to purchase an asset versus to fund spending. So when you buy a home and you buy an asset, you're borrowing money to purchase an asset that has real value and that over time you're going to build equity in. When you borrow money to buy rollerblades, you're buying something that has no essential value in terms of its, you couldn't turn around and sell it for what you just paid for it. It's depreciating in value and will ultimately become worthless. So the money that you borrowed is real. The item that you purchased is going to diminish and you will have nothing to show for it other than the pleasure factor for as long as you use it. So borrowing money to satisfy today's pleasures is generally speaking going to be bad debt. Borrowing money to purchase a real asset, which is what companies do. No big company ever got to where it got to without issuing bonds and taking on debt. But with that, they bought plant equipment, they bought real estate, and they built an empire. So that's number one. Number two is bad debt is debt that's taken with no actual plan on how you're going to pay it back. Whereas good debt, when you borrow a mortgage, when you borrow money on your home to purchase a home, you have your asset, but you also know the bank's going to take it away from you if you don't make that mortgage payment. And the trade-off is, by borrowing that money and paying it back over 30 years, you get to borrow money at a very low interest rate, which is tax deductible, and you get to slowly build equity in a really valuable asset, as we said. So the credit card debt, when it's borrowed for a real reason, right? If you need to make a home improvement as an example, right? Which is a real improvement to your home. You're putting in a kitchen. You're short $20,000. And you know that you can borrow this money and pay back over 3 to 4 months on your credit card. And you have a real plan to do that. That's perfectly okay. It's not the best way to borrow money, but if that's the only way that's available, then the answer is go for it. And that's would be constituted as good debt. So again, buying an asset, having a real tangible plan how to pay back this loan constitutes good debt. And bad debt is just something that you need to fund spending, and you really don't think about how you're going to actually pay it back.
Now, bad debt is everything else. So let's say somebody comes to you, gives you a call and says, Naftali, I'm literally up to my eyeballs in debt. I can't pay my bills. I'm helpless. Other than the financial advice, because there are nonprofits that assist people in going through the income coming in and the debts and how do we cut expenditures, how do you tell the person, and they're really stressed out unbelievably, and they say, Naftali, I need some yeshuva das in order to deal with this. How can I deal with this financial stress in order to be able to function, in order to even grapple with how to get rid of this debt? What do you tell him?
So I used to be involved much more, now less so, with Mesila, an organization I'm sure you're aware of. And I sat through some of their training sessions in the beginning to get an understanding of what Mesila counselors do and so on. And just to be clear, I don't generally counsel people on getting out of debt. It's not what I do. My general take, as we'll talk maybe a little bit later, is to make sure people don't get into debt to begin with. But the Mesila way, which I believe is the only way out of debt, is, well, first and foremost, you have to stop the bleeding. And if the leak is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, then there's never going to be a way out. And, you know, their approach begins with awareness. And awareness is the beginning of everything, as you just read my book. Awareness of why am I falling into debt to begin with? Because you can keep plugging holes, but new ones are going to be popping up all over the place. And you have to take a sort of divide and conquer approach. You have to say, all right, my debt is my debt. There's no magic wand to make it go away. Although people do, you know, discuss filing for bankruptcy and at least putting that debt on hold for a while. And that's something that a debt counselor would counsel a person on. But the first and foremost thing is you have to divide and conquer. You have to divide your life, what it costs, what it should cost, and firm up those numbers and create a true awareness of where the debt is coming from and whether or not it's justified or not. In other words, if your actual non-discretionary spending is not meeting your income, that could be one source of debt. The other debt is that you've confused discretionary and non-discretionary spending, and you continue to accumulate debt that way. So once a person has a clear understanding of what is their actual cost of living and what is the debt that is now eating up, that's the other thing. You see, the debt costs and the debt expenses are getting intermingled into your daily life. We have our daily life and we have our debt expenses once we accumulated them. So we need to understand what's the cost of living and what's the cost of accumulated debt. That's number one. Now, yeshiva das comes, first of all, with das, right? You can't have yeshiva das if you're not even in a place of das. And das is awareness, as I discuss in my book. It's a connection to real facts. It's
right. You know, we say in business, it's better to have bad news than have no news.
Exactly. This is why Taurus HaSvekos is so powerful. When a person doesn't know and things are murky or unclear, there is no yeshiva das. It's not possible. Knowing is always better than not knowing. That's why Rachman Utslan, people somehow feel better when there's a name to the disease. right? They at least I know what it is. And that's the first step. Know what it is and know where it's coming from. There will be no yeshiva das other than that, unless you have a magic wand and you can make everything go away. But even if you did, chances are in 6 months to a year, you'll be right back where you started because you haven't actually alleviated the problem. Once you have that place of knowledge and das, you can start to begin to sit down with somebody who can help you work through a plan on how to get something, get out of that debt. And that's the second part of yeshiva das, knowing you're on the right track to getting there. You see, you don't need the solution to actually play out today to have yeshiva das. You need to know you're heading in the right direction. When you don't know, it's like you're trying to get to a destination. The worst feeling is you don't even know if you're going north or south. You don't even know if you're going in the right direction. You may very well be going in the right direction, but you don't know. Your stomach is turning. As soon as you know you're going in the right direction, or you make that U-turn and you're heading in the right direction, even if you just went 20 miles out of your way, somehow there's a feeling of calm that sets in. At least I'm going in the right direction. So step two is a plan can be put in place. It may take 5 years. It may take 7 years to get out of debt. It depends on what you've gotten yourself into, but at least you know you're on the road to getting out of debt.
Right. So define for me the phrase bitachon. Somebody once made a comment to me that I did not agree with. Financial planning, that's a lack of bitachon. So how would you address such an issue of bitachon? Does it mean everything will work out blindly, or does it mean something else?
Financial planning is a lack of bitachon is the same thing as saying crossing the street with your eyes open is a lack of bitachon. If I'm meant to get hit by a negative bus, I will not get hit by a negative bus. So why should I close my eyes? Why should I open my eyes? Right? I am very makbid and shmiras einayim. So I cross in front of the street right outside of Tachan Merkazit with my eyes closed, and I say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please, I'm doing what you asked me to do. I'm keeping my eyes closed. Financial planning is basic bread and butter hishtadlus. This is living with a cheshbon. Life is meant to be lived with a cheshbon. Right. The definition of bitachon is, says the Chazon Ish, clearly in Emun and Bitachon, that whatever happens to me after I make proper hishtadlus is Ratzin Hashem, and Ratzin Hashem is ultimately good. Because with all the best financial planning, one can still encounter pitfalls, unexpected expenses. He could have erred innocently in whatever plan he put in place. For example, he builds a two-family home. He sits down with a financial planner, or a three-family home. He sits down with a financial planner. They figure out how much rental income will come in. In conservative scenarios, he takes on a certain amount of debt, he buys the two-family or three-family home, and then, bam, he hits COVID, people are not moving, and he ends up with two or three empty apartments. His debt is piling up. He can't make these mortgage payments. Now, he's sitting there, and he's second-guessing himself. He's eating himself up as alive. His wife is screaming at him, what did you do? What were you thinking? The answer is, I did what was prudent and was responsible. I made proper shtadlus. This now is where bitachon takes over. This is Ratzon Hashem. Gamzu l'tova. Things will turn around and everything will be okay.
Very good. So there's a family struggling and they need to make cuts. And let's say that they live in a neighborhood that people are fairly well off, or at least give the appearance. They spend at the level that they are fairly well off. And now we have a family that's in dire straits. They need a cut. And maybe they need to exchange those luxury cars for something more moderate and need to cut down on vacations or what would otherwise be viewed as wants, not needs. Mm-hmm. Well, what advice do you have to give to parents and parents to give to their children when they're going through a time period like this that they have to cut,
when the kid's in class and the neighbors don't have those, apparently don't have those needs. So how do we deal with the self-esteem issues and also the self-esteem of the parents and also the self-esteem of the children in dealing with those situations? I'll tell you an extreme story, and it broke my heart. I have a friend that his father is a Rav, and they had no money growing up, no money. And what they had to do was they had to get handouts from people in the community, so including clothing. So this person that I know, he comes into school and he's wearing the hand-me-down clothing. And one of his classmates says to him, "Oh, that used to be my shirt." Obviously, that's an egregious example of what we're talking about. But how would parents deal with it? And how would children deal with the situation? Their friends are going off to camp and they're no longer able to go to camp.
So this is a topic for another book. This is what I'm going to say is true for people that are going through situations or people that are not going through situations. Because we always have to keep in mind that the world, as Chazal say, is a galgal hamachzer. It's a wheel. And even if you're at the top right now, you don't know where you're going to be 3 to 4 years from now. We hope, we daven, we pray that we will always be in the station in life that we find ourselves right now. But we all know plenty of stories of people who were at the top and then found themselves towards the bottom, if not at the very bottom. And the storybooks are full of such stories of people who had great wealth and found themselves in great poverty and vice versa. So I think that the whole concept of this galgal hachayzer ba'olam, right, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Chayos above us, tells us, does not want us to connect our self-esteem and who we are to our possessions and our material wealth. And this is why it's transient. And this is why we know that it could be taken away from us at any time. So the time to start educating your children on true self-esteem and self-worth is not necessarily when things are bad. It's when things are not bad. It's when children can get what they want and even what they need to understand that this is not what makes a person, and this is not what gives them self-worth. When things are bad, when things are difficult, this is when we really, really have to buckle down. And we have to truly bring these messages to our children that ultimately, look how Reb Chaim Kanievsky lives and look who he is. Look who Reb Chafetz Chaim was and look at how he lived. And they were, if you read the storybooks, they're full of, it's unbelievable. I read my children these stories about people like the Chayza of Lublin or the Baal Shem Tov, who found themselves Friday afternoon with no challah for Shabbos. And I say, could you imagine living next door to the Baal Shem Tov and him not having challah for Shabbos? I mean, really, why don't we just take everything we have in the house and bring it into the Baal Shem Tov's house? Yet that's how these people lived. And it was not necessarily by choice. Poverty was rampant. It was rampant. We have to educate our children constantly against the religion of the masses today, which is that wealth and materialism and pleasure, the pursuit of pleasure, is what gives a person self-worth. We have to constantly remind our children that this world is over in a blink. And when you turn around after a long life, none of your material possessions are coming with you, and none of them are going to have any intrinsic worth. We're going to take with us that which we overcame, that which we became, that which we helped others become, and we have to switch our focus. And we have to show our children that these nesiyonos are meant by HaKadosh Baruch Hu for us to refocus and reprioritize what's important in life. The other thing I always tell my children is that if it were not for these difficult periods that everybody goes through, we would not become what we became. As I write in the introduction of my book, sometimes the HaKadosh Baruch Hu squeezes us, and from that squeeze and that double squeeze, and more toothpaste comes out of the tube than we ever thought imagined. We have to teach our children and share stories with them how greatness comes from adversity, and that this adversity is going to be very powerful. I'll tell you a real story, Ari, which was a truly profound lesson that I learned from my Rebbe Zichrono Livracha. My daughter was presented with a shidduch, and we never went into a shidduch without speaking to the Rebbe. So I went into my Rebbe and I laid out this shidduch. My Rebbe listened to all the parameters. I suspect that he knew something beyond what I told him, but that's okay. And he said, I do not want you to entertain this shidduch. And I said, okay. And he actually told me why. He said, let's look at the boy that you're presenting. His parents are wealthy. He is a very, very chashuv family, all the way down from some of the chashuvs, the gedolim there are. And he's tall and he's good looking. Now, this kid went through school with very little adversity. Everybody wanted to be his friend. Everybody wanted to hang around him. And he probably got away with many, many things that other people would never have gotten away with. A nasty comment here, a selfish act there. And this is why I suspect my Rebbe knew, because I did more research after that, and he was literally spot on. So he said, think about it. What makes a person a person? When the child is young and he faces adversity and he makes a nasty comment and all of a sudden nobody wants to be his friend, he learns that he can no longer make nasty comments and that he has to be nice to people. He has to share with people. He has to push himself to get good marks, to be popular. And he has to go out of his comfort zone to become something. Otherwise, as a nothing, he's never going to fit in. And it's all that forces a child to grow. If a child grows up in a pampered, entitled environment, why would they grow? I think there's a famous scientific study. If you took a caterpillar as the butterfly is pushing itself out of the cocoon and pushing and pushing and pushing, and you snip the cocoon and help him out, he will never be able to grow wings. And this is a scientific fact. It's that pushing out that allows the butterfly to push the necessary nutrients into its wings so that it can fly. And the Rebbe said that given the parameters of this boy, he doesn't believe that it's possible, that he is a built Balmidos. And he was absolutely correct.
That's amazing. It's an amazing
insight in life, how having everything can ultimately lead to having nothing. And having nothing can ultimately lead to having everything.
Right. I heard a story from a famous story that he tells from a rabbi, professor, doctor, Tversky, Abraham Tversky Zatzal. He says he walked into a dentist's office and he saw a magazine sitting there. And on the cover, it said, how do lobsters grow? And his initial thought was, what do I care how lobsters grow? And then he thinks a second, and he says, you know, that's an interesting question. How do lobsters grow? Because they have a very thick, crusty shell on them and they're stuck. So he started reading and he said the lobster, when it feels pressure because it's grown, it goes to the bottom of the ocean and it sheds its outer shell and it builds a larger one. And it goes through that process, building. When it feels the pressure, when it feels the pain, that's when it goes to the bottom and builds the next one. And he said brilliantly, so many times people in life want to avoid that pain. They want to avoid the difficulties, just take medication, avoid this problem and that problem. He says it's through the pain, it's through the challenge that there's growth. And that's what we learn through the lobster. And I think you're saying the exact same thing. So
right. Thank you for that. We really have to educate ourselves first and foremost, and then educate our children on what defines a human being. What is the intrinsic value of a human being? What is the godless of a yid? And what potential lies inside of a person? We have to build our inner self, because otherwise we're going to deeply connect to externalities. And it's from these externalities that these types of problems arise. If I'm wearing my cousin's hand-me-down hat, or I'm wearing a new Borsellino from the Borsellino store, if that is defining who I am and how I feel about myself, that's a symptom of a need to build an inner self. When you build that inner self, and when you know what your intrinsic value is and why you're on this world and what you were meant to accomplish, the hat on your head will not make all that much of a difference. Now, when somebody says to you, that used to be mine, you have to be a malach that it shouldn't give you pain. and anguish. But pain and anguish for a few moments versus knocking you off kilter and needing therapy for the rest of your life are two different things. When a person trains themselves to think differently and say, okay, that hurt, but at the end of the day, in 1 year from now, none of this is going to matter. 50 years from now, none of this is going to matter. That will not define me. That comment and whether or not I'm wearing somebody else's shirt is not going to define who I am or what I make with my life, make out of my life. And you keep reinforcing these messages to your children, and they themselves begin to think differently. And when they think differently, everything about them begins to change. And ultimately, this stuff stops mattering so much.
Right. Along those lines, when do you advise teaching children about good debt, bad debt, financial responsibility, financial stability? Is it from a very young age? Does it increase? And a similar question, if not the same question, if we have newlyweds come to you and said, we need some financial advice, what do you tell them?
Children should be taught, and this is something that, you know, we really need to work on, and there are some initiatives happening now in the Jewish community to bring better fiscal education into the school system to teach children budgeting, simple, keeping track of your checkbooks, bad debt, good debt, mortgages, how do they work? You won't be surprised. I went through yeshiva and I had no idea what a mortgage was. I knew it was this thing my tati worried about, but I had no idea what it is and how it works. Never understood credit cards. We were never taught any of these things. So we should be teaching our children the dangers of a credit card. We should be teaching our children when we are living fiscally responsible, what we're doing to be there. So for example, a person that has a credit card should have a very hard set rule that if they ever are in a situation where they cannot pay that credit card bill and that they have to go over a month, they should take a good pair of scissors, they should cut up that credit card and shred it until they pay off that credit card. And probably never use a credit card again. Maybe one infraction you should get away with. But if you do that two times or three times, and you are starting to carry debt month to month to month, and you're not shredding your credit cards, then you're living fiscally irresponsible. And children should understand that a credit card is not a borrowing mechanism. If it becomes a borrowing mechanism, it's dangerous. It's a convenience mechanism. The money's in the bank. I can easily write out a check and pay off my credit card. I just don't want to go physically to the bank to take out cash. So I use my credit card. Plus it gives me mileage and points. Fine. But at the end of that month, that credit card bill must get paid. Otherwise, it became a borrowing mechanism. And as a borrowing mechanism, it's dangerous. And my children all understand that.
So much better would be a debit card rather than a credit card.
Absolutely. Except that sometimes it's a little bit more convenient to use a credit card. But you have to be extremely diligent. Newlyweds need to understand how other newlyweds got into trouble. They need to nip it in the bud. Don't fall into debt is the first rule, no matter what. There's no excuses unless, God forbid, Hashem thrusts something upon you, which is absolutely out of the ordinary. No, what you need to do each month to make sure that you are not borrowing money from the future for the present. Because if you can't even do that when you're a newlywed, how will you possibly do it when you have five children and tuition bills and braces and summer camp? Sandy Bernstein, the founder of my former firm, became a Baal Tshuva. He died as Zalman Chaim Bernstein, as everybody knows. And they once asked Zalman Chaim why he became a Baal Tshuva. And he said what I just said. He said that I've been preaching long-term time horizon and long-term perspective to all of my clients. And I one day realized that I'm not living my life that way. I'm investing that way, but I'm not living that way. So we have to live that way. And now, living that way means that if you put all the short-term pleasure onto the scale, and then you counter that with all the long-term anxiety, pressure, also discontent by the fact that you don't live life the way you believe you should be living life. You're allowing others to dictate how you should live life, and in a way hate yourself for that and feel empty and shallow. And you put out all that into an equation over the long term, you won't be a very happy person. Whereas if you live life the way you believe life should be lived, and you don't let others dictate where and how you should spend your money, and you live responsibly and prudently, and over the long term, you don't have those sleepless nights about credit card bills that you can't pay, and you don't have those ridiculous bills that you can't handle, and you don't have all that junk in your garage that you have to make a garage sale to get rid of because it was the thing to buy at the time. And now you're in your 50s and 60s and 70s, and you have no credit card bill. You've paid off your mortgages. You go out in the morning, you take a deep breath, and you say, it's great to be alive. And you factor all that in, and you think longer term, it's a much more pleasurable way to live. Forget about Olam Haba. I'm talking about pure Olam Hazeh. Needing less, and spending less, and living within your means over the long term will give you a much higher degree of cumulative pleasure.
Naftali, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Ari. Anytime. And it's great to finally meet you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Kalten.
Joining us now is Shmuley Margulis. Shmuley is the chairman of Mesila. Mesila is an international organization there for frum people in need of assistance, in particular to achieve financial independence. Shmuley, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Shmuley, for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Shmuley, I've heard about Mesila must be on a number of 3 to 4 times in the past few months alone. But before that, I had not heard of Mesila, admittedly. Can you walk us through on a high level, what does Mesila do?
Sure. Mesila is actually, we call it a movement rather than an organization. Organization is something that does things. Mesila is a movement because a movement is a way of thinking and a philosophy. Mesila promotes the Torah approach to finances. We do it through coaching and through education. But the reason why this part of Torah, so to speak, needs a movement rather than as opposed to the rest of the Torah is because the culture that we find ourselves in, Western society, is actually makes it very difficult to manage your finances according to Torah. There's advertising and there's consumerism. The whole Western culture is very strong, pulling us away from the way our parents and grandparents knew they need to lead their lives.
So, Shmuley, I understand there was a great Rav HaMachshir who was instrumental in the Mesila. So if you can walk us through who that was and what his philosophies were and the impact until today on Mesila.
Sure. The spiritual father of Mesila is Hagun Reb Avrom Genachovsky. It was a tremendous chus that we had. He was accessible and we constantly guided us. And I'd like just to share with your listeners just a few things from Reb Avrom. I was once in New York and I met a very choshev Rosh Hashiva, told him about Mesila. So he said to me that he's concerned that when a Kohlingerman adds up his income and expenses, he'll see that it doesn't add up. And he'll come to the conclusion that he needs to leave Koil. I was greatly disturbed because that was the last thing that I wanted to achieve. Came back to Eretz Yisrael, I met Reb Avrom, and I told him about it. So Reb Avrom said to me, Mesila is not just a theory. You're actually doing things. Why don't you go ahead and take a look? Is it bringing that result or not? And what we discovered were numerous situations where it was just the opposite, where people out of despair actually left Koil because they thought that this is just not working and I've got to go work. And when we worked through their finances with them, they saw that they weren't that far from actually making it. And they actually went back into Koil. So that was very encouraging. I just want to say at the same time, Reb Avrom was adamant that when we coach Koil families, we not even present to them another option, not even to say, go ask your Rav what you should do. And we adopted this hayrua, although it wasn't easy. We had pressure from well-meaning donors who wanted us to take a different approach.
Interesting. I mean, you have these expectations and then the exact opposite happens. And I can understand that people blame the kollel for I'm not getting paid enough and I can't make it work. But if they feel that they can make it work, it papers out, it's going to, A, financially it'll work out, but it'll also decrease the stress significantly, which is obviously important as well when you're trying to focus on your learning.
Absolutely. The interesting thing is that we've discovered that the vast majority of people who come to us are actually not that far off from balancing their finances, although they think it is. We say it's between 10 and 15% that they're spending more than what they're earning. And the reason for that is because people are not just totally irresponsible. They do have a plan. They just never learned to actually sit down and make the calculations and make sure that it does add up. So therefore they deviate, but not by a lot. They do have a plan. This again is unlike what most people think. Right, so therefore, right, yeah. And the reason why people think that is because if you don't take care of that deficit, that's the monthly deficit, but from month to month becomes a year and then 2 years, and it snowballs out of control and it causes such stress that the family just sees this huge mountain in front of them and they're sure that they're way off and there's nothing to be done. And that's what people think as well. But we come and we actually break that big problem down into very small pieces and totally changes the whole picture. And then the family says, oh, thank you, I don't need you anymore.
That's a really interesting part, the snowballing, because if you look at it on a monthly basis, you're close, but it aggregates and aggregates over time. So let's talk about that family. They come in, they've got 7 kids, 3 kids, 18 kids, whatever it may be, and they're straddled with debt. It could be for them 50,000 shekel, or it could be for somebody else $50,000, or it can be $300,000. What advice does Mesila give to a family like that, that it looks impossible to dig out of a mound of debt like that?
Okay, first of all, Mesila doesn't advise. We try to understand the family, we encourage them, and we walk them on the path towards their own individual financial vision. So the way it works is, let me just walk you through quickly the coaching process. And it's not advice, we go awareness, change, and maintenance. So the awareness is first we help the family achieve their financial picture, understand their financial picture. You know, you can tell somebody there's something on your nose, or you can just hold up a mirror in front of them, it's much clearer to them. So it's not an easy process, but it takes a bit of time, but we get to a clear financial picture. Once the family has that financial picture, they see, together we see, what brought them into debt and what they need to do to stop the bleeding and actually get onto a path to have the debt decline. But again, that's the awareness stage. When they realize what the options are, the change stage, then they have to make a determination whether they want to enhance their income, streamline the expenses. But most cases, that's a combination of both. But again, it's completely up to the family to decide what the combination will be. I just want to say one thing. We don't bring advice to the table, but we do bring a positive attitude and a deep belief that every family can actually make it. And that's contagious. That's very helpful to the family. So we spoke about awareness, spoke about change, and then there's maintenance, which is the third stage. We together create a long-term plan to actually reach, fulfill, materialize the vision that the family creates for themselves.
Now, Shmuley, is this something new? Mesila's been around for at least 20 years. You've been involved for 20 years at least. Was this something that was necessary, if we say, going back 30, 40, 50 years ago? Has there been a dramatic change in spending habits and culture and availability of credit for people that has dictated that we have a need for a Mesila nowadays that maybe didn't exist a couple generations ago?
Absolutely. You're 100% right. Our parents and our grandparents, at least the vast majority of them, I remember from my own parents, my own grandparents, they absolutely didn't need it. It was deeply ingrained. It's just become much, much more complex. Like we mentioned before, there are strong forces out there trying to pull us off track to spend beyond our means, spend things on things that we don't actually need. And they explain to us why we do need it, but it's difficult. It's become complex. And our parents and grandparents simply didn't prepare us for these challenges because they didn't exist in those days. Like you said, there's consumerism, there's advertising, there's availability of credit. I remember when the first Gemach opened in London, nothing compared to the huge industry that we have today, apart from the banks and everything like that.
I could tell you from London, from that delightful accent that you have. So
thank you.
Everything you say sounds intelligent, Shmuley, I have to tell you. So yeah, our grandparents didn't prepare us because this wasn't an issue so much for them or not at all. How should we be preparing our children, grandchildren? Should we actively be discussing budgeting or responsibility or be careful about spending and not taking loans that we don't need? How should we handle this? And if you're going to say that we should speak with our children about it, how do you do that? Do you sit at dinner and schmooze with them about it? Should it be a weekly conversation? How should we go about doing this education?
This is actually my favorite topic because there's prevention and there's cure. So we know that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. Rather than deal with families with a lot of, once they're already in a lot of pain, let's teach the children ahead of time to do that. And Masila is actually doing that. Of course, you know, when the chusin and the kala or teenagers is obviously very relevant because they're much closer to actually beginning their own homes. And it's one of those things that we're just not used to training our children towards. But over and above that, even young children can learn the basic principles. And, you know, this is not about your family home finances, obviously, because that's not relevant for young children, especially. But what is relevant to them is needs and wants, just to understand the difference, because the confusion is there. Once a kid sees something in a store, suddenly he absolutely needs it. And just to help them understand the definition without going into whether they can get it or they can't get it. There's another class that Masila teaches is how, this is something that's maybe a little easier for the teachers to teach rather than the parents, is how to express to your parents when you want something. You know, you can make a tantrum or you can say everybody has it or all kinds of things, applying pressure to them, or you can do it in a respectful way. And it's even a chesed to help the children understand that no, your parents do not have an unlimited amount of money regardless of their financial situation. And to be considerate, it's simple, ben odem l'chaveroi, over and above the kibud avim, and teaching children how to express what they want from their parents and to understand when the parent says no, it doesn't mean that they don't love them. So that's more for teachers than for parents. And parents can, if you're capable, you can teach such things to your children as well. And having an open conversation about these things. You know, most parents are feel threatened to even discuss this with their children. And they should get the courage and the confidence to understand that the reason that they're not buying it is not because they're incapable or not because they're not good parents, just the opposite. And this is a conversation that they can have with their children to understand what brings happiness and what doesn't bring happiness and what life is really about. And it's a great chesed to give your child the tools of being successful in life financially.
Now, I got to imagine we're not going to say advice, but the philosophy is obviously spend when you need. There's a difference between needs and wants. How does somebody deal with it when they live in an environment, a neighborhood, a society that spends freely and thinks about today and doesn't worry about the debt that is accruing? We'll deal with that tomorrow, or we won't deal with it tomorrow. But we're trying to advise or teach a family to not be spending. And meanwhile, that's difficult on the parents to drive a less expensive car. And it's especially difficult on the children. Everyone is going off on vacation and going to camp and has fancier clothing, and we're trying to be responsible. How do you condition a family, and how does that the parents condition the children to make that mind shift and really avoid the social issues of being different from everyone else?
It's a great question. I'm uncomfortable with associating Mesila with restricting expenses, because that's not what we're about. If you can afford it and you can make it add up, go ahead and spend on what you want. But nevertheless, I know what you're asking, and however much you earn, if you're not responsible when it comes to spending, you face a risk. And just as you know, as from Jews, we're anyway used to withstanding certain pressures. You know, as a Elachid, we understand that we've got our limitations, and we don't look at that as, wow, how do you manage to do that? Because we know that's our Yiddishkeit. We're confident, we understand its importance, and that makes it easier. So what we're saying is that if you look at this as really a Torah requirement, how the Torah wants you to live your life. If you've got a strong yes in your life, all the no's become easier. So we lead our lives this way, and we teach our children this way of what's important in life, what we're trying to achieve in life. And you can't have everything. Nobody can have everything. And we lessen the importance of materialism, of material things. Of course, it's not easy. I'm not suggesting that it is. But the more that we chaz zechan again and again what our true priorities are, and we talk to our children about it, so they understand, they actually take pride in their way of life, and they can come to a stage where they're proud of things that they don't have rather than proud of things that they do have.
That's certainly a milestone to get to.
Not easy, but achievable.
Yes. Yes. I when thinking about financial responsibility, and that could be getting in more revenue or cutting out expenditures, I really equate that. I think of it as like going on a diet, in the sense that if you're committed, then you'll be successful. But the biggest challenge of going on a diet is being committed. And I would think the same thing applies with the financial responsibility. It's like tightening the belt, right? It's tightening the belt, and you need to be committed. So how do you get people committed? And how do you, as Mesila, not waste time with people who are not committed?
Okay, very good question. I'm sorry for correcting you again, but I just struggle with hearing Mesila compared to a diet and belt tightening, because that's restrictive and disciplined. Whereas what we're about is empowering and giving people control of their finances and actually strengthening them. But nevertheless, you're 100% right that it needs a commitment. And that's one of the main reasons why we actually charge for our services. You know, that we have many times well-meaning relatives and friends who are concerned about our family's struggles, and they turn to us, and we have to insist that the family themselves make the call. And people say, come on, what's the difference who makes the call? But there is a big difference, because that first step of making the call shows that they're interested. And when they actually pay the fee, may not be a huge fee, but nevertheless, somebody puts some of their own hard-earned money into something, it confirms that they're interested, and actually enhances it. And normally it actually makes them committed to the success of the process, which is crucial. So you're absolutely right.
So how much is the fee? How much is the fee?
The fee is, in Eretz Yisrael, we're talking about 1,800 shekel. It's in the range of $500, which is not an insignificant amount, especially when the family is struggling. And many people say this to us: we're struggling and you want to take another $500. So what we say is, we're not teaching you to cut your expenses. We're teaching you to spend wisely. And there will never be or rarely be a wise spending as these $500. Why do I say so? Because we recently surveyed close to 100 families, and they spent around that amount. and it was about three or four times that amount on a monthly improvement to their family finance. So spending one time $500, but improving your finances monthly by $1,000 or $2,000 is a no-brainer. Nevertheless, we encourage families, do your research, find out, ask other people, but the results speak for themselves. And yes, it still shows that they're committed, regardless of how we sell it to them. Spending that amount of money creates the commitment and confirms that they're committed, and brings them on our side of the table. And together, as a team effort, will Siyata Deshmaya be
Matzliach. Yeah, terrific. So give me two success stories that you've seen.
Okay, I'll give you, you know, we've got many success stories, although I don't personally coach families. I never did. But nevertheless, here and there, Rabban Shalom is kind to me, and I hear about our success story. I'll give you two that had debt, just because that's what your show is about, but we help people without debt as well. Because this person had $100,000 in debt, and he came to the coach in a completely lost and with no hope at all. And they discovered that he was an employee, but actually had cheshek to continue doing the same thing on his own, but he was unsure whether he's qualified. And together with the wife, actually encouraged him to do that. And he has now a successful business that he opened. And he's debt-free. So again, there was a hopeless situation, but you know, together as a team, managed to coach him towards that, and he's now debt-free. There's another one where it was the wife who opened the business. They had $300,000 in debt. The wife had an old plan, which she thought was just a dream and not realistic, and she actually opened the business. They're not debt-free yet, but they actually achieved a surplus where they were before in a significant deficit, and they now have a surplus, and they have a long-term plan to eliminate the debt. And there are many more. Believe me, there are many more. But the common denominator is that there was a determination by the family to achieve this dream of financial stability. The coach was committed and motivated them, and they had tremendous siyata deshmaya. There are many, many stories of out-of-the-box solutions, and almost every family has a solution.
Shmuley, if somebody wants to contact Mesila, how do they go about doing that? Website?
All of the above. Yes, we have a website, mesila.org, and info@mesila.org is the best way. There are phone numbers here in America and in England, which are hard for me to remember, maybe. But that's the one-word answer is info@mesila.org.
Mesila with one L.
Correct.
Okay, super. Shmuley, a pleasure having you on the show. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Be well.
Joining us now is Rabbi Beryl Wein. I had the privilege of being at Rabbi Wein's house, and we had an extensive discussion about various things. And towards the end, I asked Rabbi Wein, I would love to hear your thoughts on living in debt. Give us some insights that you've seen over the decades of your being a Rav.
One of the great pitfalls in life is the accumulation of debt, borrowing money. The halacha is that one is not allowed to borrow money if one does not have any ability, so to speak, to pay it back. That's stealing. And one should therefore never overreach in accumulating debt. You can't take a $300,000 mortgage when you know that you can't make the monthly payments. And even though it's very humbling not to be able to have what you want to have, believe me, it's much more humbling not to be able to pay back. And running from one gemach to another gemach, or from one person to another person, it's a sickness. It's an addiction. Just like drugs is an addiction, debt is an addiction. So reasonable debt you can deal with, right? You buy an automobile, you pay it out. You buy a home, you have a reasonable mortgage. But you cannot put yourself in a position of having too large debt that requires enormous amounts of money to service it. and chas v'sholem to borrow from people that will that are dangerous to borrow from. You should never do that, no matter what the issue is. So I know all of this is pious talk, but nevertheless, it's a world of experience here. And especially if you're in a position of communal respect, you should never get yourself into a situation of debt, because that will diminish everything else. The rabbi said it very well. A borrower is a slave to the lender. He's an absolute slave. And therefore, one has to be careful in all of these things, not to overreach.